It is now time to introduce our facilitators for the weekend. I have heard of Kent Coleman for many years. I've listened to his CDs, and I had him come on our sponsorship family call a few months back, and he gave us a talk about the 11th step that was it was so sincere and rooted in the practical application of how these practices, which for some of us are, you know, the occasional inspiration, but they become integrated and a working part of who we are as a human being. And that's what he embodied that morning. And I'd already asked him and Ralph, because, you know, Ralph is my sponsor and Ralph and Kent are very close. And I thought it would be an awesome, special experience to have these two men together. And I look forward to getting to know Kent more over the course of the weekend, but I know the message, and the message is the language of the heart, and it's what this weekend's all about. The gentleman to his left, Mr. White here, I would like to say that our relationship was forged in fire. I was hosting him in 2017 in February, and it was in the middle of my marriage falling apart and my dad transitioning and passing away. And, you know, my wife at the time had some signs of maybe struggling with this illness, and she had a blackout episode at the house while Ralph was staying with me, and Ralph held my hand. And then he continued to hold my hand as my father was passing away. And at that point in my life, I needed a gentle, real man in my life. And that's what Ralph has been. He is a gentle giant that speaks the language of the heart. And you guys are in for a treat with these two gentlemen. And without taking any more of their time, I give you Ralph White and Ken Coleman.
My name is Ralph White. I'm an alcoholic.
My name is Kent Coleman. I'm an alcoholic.
And my sobriety date is October the 11th, 1986. And you know, I'm getting close to another. So now I don't want to claim this. I don't want to claim I'm 36 years. You know, now I'm tired of being 36. I'm this close to 37. I want to be 37, but I'm 36 years sober. And where I come from, we don't front. So you know what I'm saying? You know, I was at a convention one time, and my birthday was the day after the countdown. And it was an early one. You know, I think I was about 3, getting ready to be 4, something like that. And I'm like, oh, my classmates are standing up for 4. I don't want to be 3. You know, anyway, that's an aside. That's just to let you guys know, don't take the guy up front so serious, you know. Terry gave me a lot of, you know, he gave a lot of accolades, and I appreciate them. But I'm a guy. I play ball, you guys, and I don't know if this is going to resonate with everybody in the room, but when I played low league ball, you know, I would have my uniform, and I never wanted to come home with a clean uniform. Sometimes, because if you come home, for those who don't know, ladies, that meant you were on the bench. You didn't even play. And not only, you might have played, but I'm going to get dirty. I don't want to come home with a clean uniform in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not that guy. I'm not the guy that you invite to come out and I'm up here and you, no, I fall down. I scrape my knees. I fall on my face. I'm in life. I get my hands dirty. I'm not scared. I do things, so sometimes it feels like I've done some things. And then later on, when you let it play all the way out, you say, okay, I got a partner, Danny F., and Danny says, two things happen, Ralph, with every experience, lessons and blessings. Lessons and blessings, you know. So anyway, and Tarek was admonishing you guys, you know, don't do too much moving around. The speakers will get distracted. Me and Ken come from dope houses, and you know, it's... I was sitting in a spot one time, somebody came up in the spot, you know, and they came up in there, shotgun. I came, the door was literally just standing on hinges, and me and my brother went in. This is the logic of a smoker, right? Oh, the police won't be back here for a long time. They was here earlier today, you know, and so. Conversely, I've been in spots where somebody, usually a woman like Sydney or Leslie, and they run the house. It's their house. And they shh. So I'm accustomed to sitting up and following directions also. I get interested when a new person comes around and say, I can't follow. Depending on how bad you have what I want. How much I'm willing to listen to. I can't follow. I'm a grown-ass man. Can't nobody tell me nothing. This youngster was serving across the street from me, and he'd be sending me to the store to go, you know, get something for me. I come back, man, did I forget anything? Depend on how bad you have what it is that I want, the lengths that I'm willing to go to, you know. And so, as you can see, Kent and I don't have anything rehearse. I like what Tarek talks about, language of the heart. So you'll hear from two guys who've been on this path for a moment. And what we'll be sharing is our experience. I'm victimized when I use that word experience in a couple of ways. One, I'm the kind of guy that thinks if it ain't my experience, you lying about it being yours. And I have a companion, and I got a companion piece to that. My experience is the experience. So it is very important, and we'll put those themes right up here on the board. You know, if it ain't my experience, you're lying about it being yours, and my experience is the experience. And as we navigate through the rest of the weekend, I'm going to refer back to some of those, because when we talk about the third step, when we talk about this business of playing God, my experience is the experience. When we talk about this business of bondage of self, you lying about it being, all those kind of, they come back, you know, they resonate. You know, when we talk about 6 and 7 and you say, it's only 2 paragraphs in 6, the whole book is 6 and 7. The whole book is about, you know, relieve me of the bondage of self. The whole book is about, you know, we had to be rid of this selfishness. The whole book is about, we had to quit playing God. The whole book, so 6 and 7, it's discreetly put out right there, but that's not, you know, that's not where it just sits. So I guess the reason I'm overviewing with you guys like this is for this reason. Ken and I are going to navigate through our journey, our respective journeys, you know, through this process. And we're also going to hopefully give a look at how, for it, at least, and I know, you know, I know Ken, I got 5 brothers. I got 5 biological brothers. And Kent is like a brother to me. I don't need extra brothers either. You know, a lot of people come in here and say, y'all are closer to me than my family. I got a close-ass family. You know, I got a tight-knit family. We, you know, I got a strong family. I got a strong family ethic. So for me, the fact that I found family in Alcoholics Anonymous is not so much commentary on the fact that I was a guy that came in here lacking. It's commentary on the fact that this fellowship and this program and some things I've discovered here are so powerful. They've added. They've added to a full part of my experience. Because I don't, you know, Leslie can tell you, you know, particularly now that we're sober, you know, I got a bomb family. I'm reflecting on that because of some recent stuff. So I started getting loaded, you know. Brandon and Tarek, I really want to thank them because they disturbed my spirit about some stuff. And not in a bad way, they shook some stuff loose because I didn't know what we would talk about. But those two gentlemen, they took me a couple of places. And Brandon, he mentioned something that, and I was like, wow. You know, he mentioned a couple of things that made me reflect. He was talking about when he went to one page in the book and he said, this guy, he didn't know whether or not he was a guy that shared the same problem. So Ken and I are gonna let you know really briefly, you're not gonna have no doubt. Oh. They need to be up in this piece. You know, please don't bar the door. Do not let these two out on their own. You know, I started drinking, you know, when I started my freshman year in college. You know, I'm from L.A., and so I went off to UCLA when I was 18 years old, green, rookie, you know, because I'm a high-achieving guy. So I didn't start getting loaded early like some of our previous speakers. I started getting loaded late in life, you know, freshman year, at UCLA, excuse me. And so I'm drinking and I'm smoking commercial weed, and this is 71. 73, I first got introduced to blow, you know, and people of a certain age, I like the Miles and Sid are sitting up here in the front, because I, you know, they got gray too. You know, and people of a certain age will respond. Some of y'all don't know. What are you talking about, blow? You know, because y'all came out smoking, you know. I remember, yeah. You know, I did the normal progression, you know. And it's some young people in here, and y'all went from 0 to 60. I see you, Philippe, sitting in the back. Y'all went from just, but I did the normal progression. Boone's Farm, Annie Green Springs, Spinata, Tyrolia, commercial weed, Colombian, Thai, started blowing in 73. You know, some hash oil. You notice I'm mentioning all that, but you, the moment I get to hitting the pipe, you know I'm coming to the end of my story, right? So, but I did the normal progression, you guys. So in 73, somebody introduced me to some blow, and we the only people introduced me like it was some formal ritual. Ralph, me, you know. But and I turned it down because that's real dope. And I grew up, believe it or not, I was staunch. You know, in my community, I'm out of Watts in the 60s. It was a changing and turbulent time. I've always been a brother that thought I would leave footprints. I've always thought I would be an asset in my community. I've always wanted to do something important. I got a mom. Kent and I have a lot of stories that his mom was really big and active in the National Baptist Union. My mom was big in Baptist Union. And so, but I always grew up with, well, what our book calls a code of morals and philosophies, better philosophies. I grew up with that. I knew right from wrong. And as a young kid, I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to be an asset in my community. I would look at what PCP was doing, I was doing anti-PCP rallies. I was a drug counselor as a kid, you know, and all the counselors smoke weed and drink. Because, you know, heroin and PCP was drugs. What we was doing, that's fun, you know. And so I start on this. And so the first time it got put in front of me, I turned it down. The next time, one of the dudes on the football team that we were going to play, see on Sundays. So he was, that's up Ralph's alley. You know, I told you all this other stuff about how I was going to be an asset, but I'm a perpetrator. You know, I'm the kind of guy that I am. I'm trapped in what I think you think about me, and it's very important, you know, that I frame the narrative and make you see who it is I want you to see. I've been so wed to how I was as a kid. You know, me and Les talk a lot all the time. Sometimes I still feel like that guy is there, but this process has done something with me. And to be honest, I walk like I walk. And to be honest, I really don't. You know, something has happened with me, and that's the promise of doing what it is we do, you guys, that I pretty much walk like I walk and say what I say. And I'm really not trapped in what I think you, but that I still sometimes hear myself say that in my story, because I still remember myself. You know, we have a hard drive, I think, and it takes a while to erase that data. And so I still feel like the shy little boy, you know, and I'm 70 years old. It's been a long time since I've been that guy. It's been a long time since I've been dominated by what I think people think. But sometimes that narrative comes up. But anyway, so I snort this next time it comes around. And so I start snorting and I start blowing and I start living life. And I had a lot of fun in the life. I'm an example of the progression of the disease of alcoholism. There are many people who come out to shoot. First time out the gate, I was alcoholic from the beginning. Our stories are all over. That's why we tell our stories. We tell our stories for a number of reasons. It's instructive in the book. Everybody knows in chapter 5, we talk about our story show in a general way. What we used to be like, that's the mugshot, you know, and really, and why is the mugshot important? Because you can't appreciate what I am now if you don't know where I come from. It don't mean nothing. You know, if I came up in here and I was always Deacon White, that wouldn't mean nothing that I don't get loaded today, you know. So our mugshot, our stories, you know, and the most powerful thing about our stories, Derek talked about that. I think the most powerful thing, you guys, when you think about it, how do you put voice to transformation? How do you put grace in words? How do you put, you know, how do you put spiritual experience? How do you put it in words? Well, we found the language of spirituality, the language of this seeking that we do, is found in storytelling. It's ancient. You know, every organization, every group, anything that's dedicated to seeking in life is storytelling. And guys like me made the mistake of thinking in those stories that most of the religious stories and the rest, I made the mistake of thinking they were supposed to be taken literally, and they weren't. But in here, we found that storytelling is the best avenue for showing the power of our fellowship. And the power of our fellowship is not found in the dissemination of information and knowledge. That's cool. You come to a weekend up here, you can take note, there's going to be a lot of information dispensed. That one right there, you talk about a fount of information, knowledge, wisdom, grace, dignity. It's a lot of that. But the power of our fellowship is not the information, it's the transformation. It's the transformation. And the best way to communicate transformation we've found is through stories. You see transformation. You know, I pointed at Sid, I see transformation best in our ladies. Every time I see Lindsay, when I come out here, I still get excited because, you know, our stories, this is the power, you guys, in the stories. Isn't it interesting that the person that's telling the story is not the person that's in the story? When you heard Tarek telling the story, coming out in shackles, I'm visual. You know, we binge watch stuff, and I could see him, you know. I could see him shackled at the ankles, shackled at the neck, and then he turned, and Moms is sitting over there, and Moms is broken, because people like us, we break people. We don't mean to. Guys like us, we're heartbreakers. We don't mean to be, we don't want to be, but I got that thing. And if I got that thing, anybody in my blast radius has that thing, whether they want it or not. That's the cool thing about the disease that I suffer from. You know, it's so communicable, you know. And so when Tarek was telling that story, most of you guys know Tarek. And so if he doesn't tell that story, I wouldn't know that story was in him. The guy that's telling the story is not the guy that's in the story. And that's why we tell them. And hopefully, the longer I'm around, the starker the contrast. When I was new, you could still pretty much kind of hear, oh, yeah. Yeah, hair still, you know, I'm wearing my waist was a size 28. You know, it was real easy to see. But the longer I'm away from it, hopefully, not bragging, but hopefully, God has done something with me. Hopefully, this process that's outlined in our 12 steps has done something that it's designed to do. And hopefully, his deportment shouts it out. You know, so that's what we do, and that's what we do. And so I thought I was going to do a lot of talking about surrender, concession, you know, and early recovery. I've spent a lot of talking about who knows what, but that's what you're going to get, you know, this weekend. But I'm 33 now. I'm 32 years old, and I'm smoked out. You know, I'm at my mama's house. I'm married, but I'm put out the house now. You know, I got a 2-year-old daughter. This is the year of 1985 when I go to stay at my mother's house, and I'm doing the best I can, you guys. My old man, I didn't have an old man at the house. I listened to Brandon when he talked about his father and his mom. And sometimes I long for that. I'm going to touch on that when we talk on one of the later sessions. Can't remind me, Ralph said he going to touch on his dad when we start talking about 4 and 5 maybe. But I had a little envy about that. I didn't have a dad. But my earliest vow, you guys, and I had some vows as a kid, You know, I was a guy that was a goal setter. I'm an achieving guy. And one of my vows was, I'm going to have a nuclear family, and my kids will never wake up outside of their house. They're going to have a mom and a dad, and they're going to, and that's how they're going to be raised, right? Well, in the year of 1985, that happened to me in the life that also repeated, that theme repeated sober, at 22 years sober, when I went in my third valley in sobriety. We'll hopefully touch on that during the weekend. But I got put out of my house in 1985 with a two-year-old daughter, and I want to be a dad with everything in me, right? And my wife would bring my daughter over, and this is weekend with dad. And I really want to be a daddy to my girl, but I'm smoking, right? Remember that. So this particular Saturday, my mom is out of town. Me and all five of my brothers were back in my mama's house. We almost killed my mom in the year of 85. My mom was on vacation, and so she was out of town. They bring my ex-wife brings my daughter over, and this is weekend with dad. My daughter, I would put her in my mother's bedroom. This particular Saturday, I put her in my mother's bedroom to watch cartoons about 11 in the morning. Me and my brothers are in the front bedroom. We're smoking and we're drinking. And Ralph, on this particular weekend, being a good dad, because I'm spending Saturday with my daughter, I go to the bedroom where she was when it wasn't my turn for a hit. And I'm sprung, right? So you know what I'm doing. I'm not standing still. I'm pacing. Rain is watching Scooby-Doo or TV or whatever she's doing. I'm pacing till one of my brothers come and relieve me and say, it's your turn again. And he stands in the room and he paces with his niece while I go up in the front and take my hit. And then we revolve and we do that that constant revolving, you know, musical chairs deal with my daughter that particular Saturday till her mom picked her up. And I've never talked to her. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Ralph White at his best, being the best dad he could be under the influence. But I spent the weekend with my girl. You know, we had a thing last week. We were sitting with my mom. Last weekend, they gave me a 70th birthday party. I turned 70 on 9/11. And they had a party. And my daughter, who I was pacing in front of then, she was two. When I got to you guys, she was 2 and a half. She's 40, practicing attorney in the state of California. But we were there, and my mom said, Ralph, because my daughter talked at this thing they gave for me, just blew me away, you guys, blew me away. And my mom said, Ralph, I am so happy and proud. And this is, I've been doing this, you guys, 36 years, so I get this from my mom. But I heard a new story that I didn't know. She said my daughter used to sit when my mom was watching her when I was smoking. My daughter would sit with her grandmother, and my mother would be doing whatever she was doing, and Rain would sit by herself. And my mom said she'd be talking to herself, and she'd say, okay, my daddy's gonna come home, and he's gonna come in the door, and I'm gonna jump up. He's gonna come in the door and say, hey, big girl. And I'm gonna jump up and say, hi, daddy. What are we gonna do? And he's gonna come and no dad. Over and over. We just heard that story. And it pierced me like in a butt. Even hindsight, retrospect. When we read, you guys, we would not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. That doesn't mean any thinking person does not mean that there are not some things I regret. Hell yeah, I regret giving my mama sleepless nights. I regret it. I regret putting my daughter through that. I don't regret the past. I don't regret what it is that brought me to you. But as a thinking, feeling, compassionate man right now, if I could do it over. We're going to talk about amends, you know, this weekend, too. Oh, if I could have a do-over. If I could have a do-over. But I get a do-over because I got those grands. I got those grands. And they've never seen that daddy. I got a younger daughter. She's never seen that daddy. And that big girl, I get a do-over. I get to sponsor men and women. I get to talk to them. I get to see them bringing theirs into this world. I get to let this power transform every single thing that I've ever regretted. I get to let this power put it in his hands, because I do what it is I do, but he'll spend it in the gold. He'll spend it into something that makes me useful. He'll spend it into the most valuable commodity I have right now, you know, and that's my experience. We don't sponsor, Kent and I, hopefully we're going to talk about things like sponsorship. We'll talk about things like family, you know, and sponsoring is, your asset in sponsorship is not your successes. That's not that, that. I mean, that's cool. It gives hope. It gives inspiration. When you really care about your sponsor, like I care about mine, you know, sometimes I get encouraged. But your currency in sponsorship, all you sponsors, how many people in here sponsor? Your currency in sponsorship, get dirty. Scrape your knees. Remember it. Remember when you bloody your nose. Remember when you make a fool out of yourself. Remember, and share it. And learn, I mean, that's I think if it's anything, Tara gives me some, you know, for me, I sponsor a lot of people, and a lot of people think they get something. And for me, what that means is, dude, you done fell on your face a whole lot of time. And God, because you got a whole lot to give to people, you know, and wow, I thought I was going to do a lot more talking about concession and surrender, but God do what he do. And these two just shook something out of me. I'm going to turn it over to Ken Cole. My name is Ralph White. I'm an alcoholic.
Ken Coleman, an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 18th, 1992. I'm a member of the Venice Group. I have a sponsor. His name is Bob D. He lives in Las Vegas, Nevada. I am honored to be here. Tarek said something struck me right here. As Tarek said, like, sometimes you got to come in here. And Brandon said, I had to come here last year, you know, and pull off the energy I come to get. I just show up. Sometimes I show up because I'm asked to show up and share, and I'm the one who receives. See, I don't know what God's plan is. Somebody will say something to me out there in that hallway and redirect my life even more in the right direction. I never know. But I'm grateful to be here. It's an honor and a privilege to be here and to be here with my partner. We've been doing this for over 25 now. And he's talking about, I see this gray up. We didn't have no gray when we started doing this. And we have walked through life in here. And recovery, Ralph talked about the dope house. We came from the dope house. Yes, we did. Now, and then let me say this, right? Because Ralph said the door was hanging off. Well, the police were just here. They won't be back for a while. They knocked my door down, the police did, with a battering ram. And it was wintertime. So, you know, they came in, they did what they do, and I went downtown, and then I got bailed out, and I came back. The candles was lit. We was very romantic in those days. The candle was lit, and somebody said, ain't you going to put the door back on? I said, for what? They'll be back. And most certainly they was, right? But I was sitting here listening to Ralph. Listen, Ralph and Leslie know my girlfriend, Janelle. Ralph know my daughters, Alyssa and Jordan. They, Alyssa, 24, Jordan about to be 22. My granddaughter is 2. Her name is Caroline. And let me tell you something. When my kids were little, my oldest daughter said to me one day, "Daddy, is granddaddy your daddy?" I said, "No, he is not." I said, "That is not the same man that lived in the house I lived in. His granddaddy is a fictional character." My kids could go in his house and set fire to the couch, and he'd let there and sit there and go, "Ain't they cute? That ain't the man was in my house, right?" Check it out. Now I'm granddaddy. And if she want to set fire to my house, I will give her the matches, right? You don't go from the dope house to the life I got today without God. You don't go from where I was to where I am today without God. I am sorry, left to my own devices, and none of the, I have no power. I have no power. I'm gonna talk about a couple things real quick. Okay, I was, as Ralph said, we were raised very similar. My mother strong in the Baptist church. My mother was president of Ohio Baptist Women's Convention. My mother was an executive at Chrysler at a time when women wasn't executives and black women definitely wasn't executives. I'm talking 60s and 70s. My mother was a power. If she walked in here right now, this room would get twice as bright. My mother was a power. She glowed with it. We knew the difference between right and wrong before we ever got on the school bus to go to kindergarten. I've learned nothing here that I wasn't already taught. The principles that we have in our steps are ancient. They didn't start in 1935 over in Akron. They are ancient. And check this out. There are people who live like that every single day. And check this out. They don't expect a pat on the back for it either. My family is not impressed that I'm 31. They happy, right? Because I'm one, like Rel said, if you within my orbit, you get what I got. They happy. I was sober a few years, and my Aunt Pat, God rest her soul, said to me, what do you do when you travel around? And I said, "Well, Auntie Pat, you know, we try to go and carry the message, be helpful to other people." And she turned around and looked at me, and she patted me on the shoulder. She said, "That's good, Kenny. We do that every day." I had an older brother and a younger brother. My older brother was my hero. He was a football player. He was a real good football player. He was recruited to go to Ohio State University. I had 2 cousins, played in the NFL for a long, long time. My family played football. That's what we was raised to do. My father played at West Virginia State. His little brother, my Uncle Bo, played at Penn State. My family played football. That's what we do. My brother was all them rolled up into one. And Woody Hayes came to our home, and my brother's going to Ohio State. This is 1971 when that took place. 1972, my brother suffers a head injury in a scrimmage. I'll make a long story short, he dies 5 days later as a result of that. I'm gonna give you a little quick insight. I've always been shy, I've always been insecure, I've always been afraid. I was an avid reader. I could read before I went to school. My mother used to take me to the library. I would get a stack of books. I found relief in books. I'm somebody else. I'm someplace else. I'm doing something else. I found it in television, movies, daydreaming. Life was uncomfortable for me. It was just uncomfortable. I always felt a half a step behind everybody else in life. It's like people are talking about stuff I don't know nothing about. People are doing things and going places I don't go and things I don't do. And I always feel somehow I'm missing something. Something ain't right. My first drink of choice was my older brother. I followed him everywhere. I lived in his shadow. They used to call me Brian's little brother. And he was larger than life.
He was not just a sports thing. He had what they call perfect pitch. He played the guitar. And one day my mother came home and put on The Thrill Is Gone by B.B. King. And he sat there and listened to it. He had heard it before. And he picked up his guitar. They bought him a Gibson guitar. B.B. King had a Gibson, I think. And he plugged it into the amp, and he told my mother, turn it off. And he sat there and he played it. And if you close your eyes, you couldn't tell. He was one of them kind of people. They come along every now and then. And so he was my hero. He was my protector. He was a great guy. But if you came at him sideways, he'd break your neck. My brother was not a guy to be trifled with. All of a sudden, he is gone. And I'm 13 years old. And that didn't make me an addict or alcoholic. What it did is it just seemed to increase the difference between me and you, because now everywhere I go, there's an elephant in the room. It's 1972, not 2023. They didn't send counselors to the school. Nobody know how to deal with it. This almost killed my mom and daddy, and I ain't gonna tell you what it did to my grandparents, so like I'm just out there, right? And I ain't talking, and I'm gonna deal with it. And one day I get in a car with a guy I played basketball with in high school. I was 14 or 15, and he said, you wanna get something to drink? My family does, I always say alcoholism don't run in my family, it gallops. Man, well, I have been told, I have seen plenty of evidence, right? When my family have a family reunion, they get two shelters out at the park. One for the good folk and one for the rest of us. And I was over there with the rest of them. And look at your Uncle Ed, look at Junior, look at Bobby, all of them died of cirrhosis. But if I had, when I got in the car with Johnny that day, if he would have said, let's go rob the carry out, I guarantee you that I would have. Ralph talked about what I think you think of me. Right? Like my entire existence was based on what I thought others thought of me. I had a personality for every group of people that I was around. I had one for the church people. I had one for the guys on the corner. I had one for the guys I played ball with. I had one for the teachers in school. I will be whatever it is I think I need to be to gain your approval. That's how I was. And, we bought 10 quarts of Sliss Malt Liquor Bull, dropped the convertible top on that Pontiac, cranked up the Parliament Funkadelic, and we drank that beer. And all I would tell you is this. We talk about the effect produced by alcohol. Sky got bluer, grass got greener. We went behind the Derrick Apartments. I told people stuff about themselves I had been wanting to tell them for years. People leaned in the car, hugged me, and what they said was, told you, check my boy out, he's drinking, he's one of the fellas. And I connected a dot. When I drink, I change, and how I see you changes. Left from there, went over to the home of some of them girls he run around with that I ran away from when I seen them coming down the hall. Never been over there in my life. I walked into that home like I had just paid off the mortgage. I sat down, I made eyeball to eyeball with the finest girl to graduate from Sandusky High School in his 178-year history. I had never even breathed in her direction, much less said hello. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I said, come here. And she got up and started walking toward me. Now, any sane person would probably think to themselves, gee, Ken, if you wasn't so shy and scared, look what you could have done by speaking up. That ain't what I thought. Here's what I thought if you knew, stay with me. Here's what I thought if you had been drinking before now. Look what you could have done. I want y'all to get, the problem with alcoholics is in his mind rather than in his body. Stay with me. I immediately attributed it to drinking. Alcohol equals success. It is a good thing. It is an answer. It is a solution. Burning in my head. Tell you the truth, because this is an honest program, when she got over there to me, I had the faintest idea what to do with her. I don't think that far ahead when I'm drinking. But I watch a lot of TV. On TV, they go like this, so I did, right? And she sat down in my lap, and my life changed again. Make a long story short, on that day, alcohol did for me what I could not or would not do for myself, And I'm going to make this because it's a very powerful statement, but I believe it to be true for the first time in my life. And it was not true, but I believed it to be true. For the first time in my life, I felt whole. And that is a very powerful thing. It's a spiritual thing. That's why they call alcohol spirits. What happened the rest of that day, and I think this will qualify me to be here more than anything else. What happened the rest of that day, went in a blackout, have no idea what went on the next few hours. According to eyewitnesses at the house, I came in the front door, threw up a trail through the house, through the living room, through the kitchen, through the family room, went in the bathroom, hit everything but the toilet. The next thing I remember is my mom, you know how they do, knocking on that door. Come here, clean up this mess. You know you've been drinking. Smells like a brewery out here. Staggered into the hallway in what later years would be my drinking and using uniform, my underwear. Bouncing off of them hallway walls, I got a hangover, you know, kind you can take out and look at. Lock the bathroom door, go in the bathroom. She's still screaming in the hallway. I look through bloodshot eyes into the mirror, and this is what I said. Man, oh man, I cannot wait to do that again. Grounded for life is what was being talked about in the living room. And So I want y'all to follow me for a minute. First time, negative consequence. Big book talk about a man put his hand on a hot stove. Don't do it no more, right? I'm in the back. I have a meeting with myself in the bathroom. This is what I came up with. Stay with me if you knew. Okay, Ken, here's what happened. You got drunk, yep. You got sick, yep. And you got grounded for life. All this is true. But the reason, Kent, that you got grounded for life is not because you got drunk. The reason you got grounded for life is because you got sick. So what you got to do is learn how to drink, come on, without getting sick. I knew I was in the right place. See, y'all got what I got. Or normal people do not think like that. I got grounded for life. I drank with guys in high school, right? And I was a guy that people would avoid because I'd get you sick. Guys throw up in my car, I throw you in your front yard. I see you at school Monday. Hey, man, you want to roll? Stay away from me, right? Normal people, the effect, listen. Alcohol's an answer, dude. It ain't a problem. And this is the reason nobody could talk to me. This is the reason why I sat lecture after lecture shaking my head. You don't understand. It's not that. It's you. It's the police. It's the coaches. It's the neighbors. It's not that. And that's how I started. Like Ralph, I went through the normal progression. Started smoking some weed. And let me say this, you know, this is how I went off to college and no more parental interference. I had 64 bongs lining the baseboard of my dorm. This is a true story. I had a bong that had two bowls on it. I called it the twins. I used to pack the twins at night, put it by my alarm clock. When the clock went off, I shut the clock off, snatched the twins, fire them up, and when my feet hit the floor, I was high. And that's a snapshot at age 18. That's me at age 18. Kind of family I had. When I went to college, I peeled a sticker out the window of a brand new car and drove off. It's kind of mom and daddy I had. I went to one of the best schools in the country. They worked their fingers to the bone to provide for me every opportunity. So a little story, I'm gonna tell it real quick. Ralph says the foulest thing he ever heard anybody say to their mother, but I'm gonna tell it. I was in high school, I had a driver's license that said I was 22, I was 17. And I put on a three-piece suit and tie and I went to the all-beautiful Shea nightclub in Toledo, Ohio. That's an hour away. At least that's what they called it on the radio. That ain't what it was when I got there, but I didn't care. And I had a 1 a.m. curfew. I was only allowed to go to high school dances in town. And at 1 a.m., I was drinking a gin and juice, a slow dragon with a woman older than my mother. <laughs> 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm rolling down Wilbert Street in Sandusky, Ohio with a plan. You know, you got to have a plan. I'll park around the corner. I'm gonna go behind the house. I'm gonna climb in the window, right? No one will know. Come around the corner, whole house lit up. Every light in the house, oh man. Of course it was. Of course it was. Your 17-year-old son is out in the street. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. Is he alive or is he dead? I walked in the front door. My mother sat there. She got tears running down her face. And my mother told me something. She said, Kenny, I'm gonna tell you something. She said, it's your family. We owe you a roof over your head, food to eat, clothes on your back, and an education. She said, and we have fulfilled our part of the bargain. She said, but buddy, I'm gonna tell you something. I got something you can't have. She said, that's my peace of mind. She said, Kenny, you going to penitentiary or the cemetery? And I got news for you, buddy. I ain't going with you. I am done. Go, do what you want. I'm done. Tears running down her face. And this is what I said to my mom. I broke you. I broke you, mama, and I want you to know something. I'm a little disappointed. You such a spiritual giant. Because it wasn't even that hard. And I walked away. That's how I treated my mother. My mother seen me in shackles. The question that she asked was, whose gun was it? And I told her it was mine. I hit the pipe and went into cardiac arrest in 1984 and stopped breathing. Flatline. I came I was in the cardiac unit in Providence Hospital in Sandusky. Everybody up there, mama, daddy, aunt, uncle, Reverend Brown, Catholic priest. I'm laying there, I'm looking around, trying to figure out what's happening. My mother says to the doctor, I already lost my oldest son. I can't lose another one. Do what you have to do. I ain't hurting nobody. 48 hours I stayed in the cardiac unit. And the cardiologist said it was a medical miracle. His heart is perfectly normal. So we're going to keep him in a regular room, take him out of the cardiac unit. We're going to keep him in a regular room for a couple days, and he'll be fine. Laying in the cardiac unit and realizing what had happened, I said, God, if you let me live, I'm done. I'm done. And if you'd have put a lie detector on me, the needle wouldn't have moved. I meant it. I meant it as much as I mean it. I didn't want to die no more then than I do today. They took me out of the cardiac unit, put me in a regular hospital room. And I got in a regular hospital room. Here's the thought that came to me. Stay with me. Whoo, that was close. Anybody in here feel this? But I'm all right now. This calls for a celebration. I knew it. I knew I was in the right place. Bar the door, don't let us out of here. And my best friend came in the room. His name was Mark. Mark died of this disease. Mark ran out in front of a train because he dropped a bag of rocks. And he ran out in front of a train, and Mark ain't here no more. Mark came and he sat with y'all in Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. And Mark, I went to get Mark on a Saturday night. He was going to go to Saturday night AA meeting. And I pulled into his mother's driveway. He was living in his mother's basement at that point. And he came outside. And we worked at Ford Motor Company together. And Mark came outside. I know Mark since I was 3 years old. And he came outside and he said, I don't want to go, but if I ever decide I want to, I know who to call. Mark ain't going to be called. Mark died when I was 7 years sober. But Mark came in the room and I told him, I said, I need you to go. I need you to get me 2 tall boys, a Sliss Malt Liquor Bull. I need you to go buy bugs, give me an 8-ball, and give me a stem. Mark looked at me and said, you out your mind. That's why you in here. Now, this is somebody that died of this. He said, you out your mind if you think I'm going to do that. That's why you in here. And I said, you're going to need me before I need you. You ain't got no job no more. and I'm 2 hours out the cardiac unit, and I'm chugging a tall boy in the bathroom of the hospital room, and I'm hitting the stem. If I had the power to quit on my own, I'd have never come here. Why should I? I didn't come here because I didn't have nothing to do. I didn't come here looking for no girlfriend. I didn't come here looking for no job. I'm going to go about 5 more minutes, and then we'll take the break to come back at 9:15. What I'm going to tell you is this. How did I get here? I never been here before. I ain't know nobody ever been here before. I ain't care about nobody never been here before. At the end, I don't take baths. I don't take showers. I told you I worked at Ford Motor Company, and I did, and I did not have a car. It is possible. I'm going to tell you something that I usually don't tell people. I had a set of keys made of my mother's car and my father's car. My mother had a brand new Cadillac, and my father worked at General Motors. And I used to go, he worked afternoon shift 3 to 11. And I used to go over there at 3 o'clock after he'd go in the plant, and I would steal that car and I would ride all day. There was times when my father, because I was sprung, because if I get sprung, I don't go to work. I'm supposed to go to work at 11. I'm sprung, I don't go to work. My father would come out and he would not have a car. I had a liver that was distended. I was sick. I was coughing this white stuff up, and I found out later what I was coughing up was pure alcohol because my liver and my pancreas were ceasing to function. I was 32 years old, same age as Ralph, and I was dying. Of this disease. And I got in the car. I came out the pump lounge out on Route 4 with my little brother. And I had to go to work or else I'm fired. And he went back in there to go to the bathroom, and I got in the car, and I had what they call a moment of clarity or a moment of sanity. There was a guy in Cleveland, six-pack Charlie Kitchen. Charlie Kitchen died 63 years sober a couple years ago. Charlie Kitchen used to say, that's the moment when God paralyzes the liar in you long enough for you to see the truth. And what happened was my head cleared for the first time in God knows how long, and this is what I saw. If you don't stop drinking and getting high, you're going to die, and you better get some help because you can't do it by yourself, and you better do it now because you're running out of time. I'm a great believer in the power of prayer. I believe I was prayed in here. I did not come here on my own volition. I did say a lot of them foxhole prayers. I did lay in the bed at night and wonder what the hell's wrong with me. How come I can't get a paycheck and pay bills and have things like other people? I worked at Ford Motor Company. People not only had a house, they had a summer house. They had boats. They had cars. I get off work at 8 a.m. I work midnights. I get off at 8 a.m. at noon. I'm through. Y'all know. Noon. I got a whole nother week of lying and cheating and stealing to make it to another paycheck next Friday. And the paycheck gonna be short because I don't go to work every day. This is the existence that I'm living. I had 7 convictions in the state of Ohio for driving under the influence of alcohol. 7. If I had that today, I'd still be in prison, and rightly so. They cut me out of a car at the corner of Columbus Avenue and Taylor Street on a Sunday morning. Somebody called the church where my family is, announced from the pulpit that I've been in this terrible accident. My 90-year-old grandmother faints in church. My mother comes to the hospital. They got police on either side of the bed because I'm going to jail when I'm trying to stall for time. I told them my back hurt. Wasn't nothing wrong with me. I was drunk. It was 9:30 in the morning. I had been up all night. And my mother came in there and she looked at me and she said, oh, no, buddy, not again. And she turned around and walked out, and I went to jail again. I need some help. Now, we talk about surrender, and this is how I'm going to end this for now. We talk about surrender. With me, and this is just my experience, that was the beginning. That was not the end. There was something that needed to happen yet, and it hadn't happened. I was about to meet y'all. I was getting close to meeting y'all. I made a phone call. Somebody arranged for me to go to treatment, and I was about to meet you. I did not know what was wrong with me, much less what needed to be done about it, okay? So this was the beginning, and when we come back, we'll start to talk about, as we move forward, some of these things that happened that got me to that point, because it did not occur until I had been with you for 3 months. It did not occur. So with that, we're going to stop right there and take the break. Thank you.